Basketball, a game of giants. And there's number 99, George Mikan, one of the greatest.
Perhaps the most complete player the game has ever seen. The Lakers captain, Elgin Baylor.
2 seconds, 1 second. West throws it up.
Jerry West made it from the other side of the mid-court stripe.
Ford sends it to Kareem. Sky hook up and good. Lakers win.
Magic down the middle, just what I thought. A hook shot at 12. Good!
Shaquille fade away. Yes!
Giants for the win. James puts up the three. Oh, it's good!
Doncic on the drive. Step back. Puts it up. Puts it in! With 5 tenths of a second remaining!
What's up, Laker fans? You're listening to the Laker Film Room Podcast. I'm Pete, joined by Darius, and the NBA schedule was finally released. Before we get into the specifics of it, I'm curious, when this day happens every year, where do your eyes go to first?
First of all, I try to figure out when the big matchups that I care about are going to be. So I want to know who they're going to play on Christmas. I want to know when they're playing Boston, for example, and particularly the road game to see what kind of trip it's a part of. I try to get a sense of how rigorous it's going to be, how many back-to-backs there are. And then I also try to see what the last month and a half of the season looks like, particularly for the Lakers. This year, I also got a good kick out of how many national TV games they had, just based off of some of the online discourse that existed, Pete, after LeBron left, and whether or not the Lakers were going to be featured as prominently on the national schedule when they had 34 games tied for the most in the league. I sent you a text that said you and me could be there starting backcourt.
It's like, are you new here? Like, that was cracking me up, the wish casting on that. It's like, and it becomes particularly unpersuasive coming from people who it's like, you're arguing the Lakers have no motion, but like 80% of your last 100 tweets have been about the Lakers. Come on now. So yeah, that obviously was going to work out the way that it did.
Like, how much is my League Pass subscription diminished? Because basically
half
of their season
is
on national TV. And it's like, what am I actually paid for here? I'm like I paid for 45 games or something like that on League Pass. Anyways, so the sort of ebbs and flow of a season are meaningful to me, because as much as I think we judge the strength of a Lakers team based off of their postseason prospects, regular season positioning and a team's ability to be good during a regular season, I think, does portend at least somewhat to what their postseason chances are going to be. And so I'm always interested to see, okay, what does the flow of a particular year look like? And I remember it was not last season, I think it was the season before that, where the Lakers had that really rigorous month where they played 18 games or something like that. And I was just like, what kind of brutal month is this that they have? Where I honestly felt like that stretch of the year was going to sap them in a way where I was a bit concerned about what it was going to look like coming out of the other end of that. And so stuff like that is always interesting to me. I'm wondering if you take a different tack entirely when you're looking at the schedule.
I've always looked for the road trips first, and this is something that Mike was super influential. It was great potting with him for a number of reasons, but one of the things, I felt like it brought us closer to the human element of travel and fatigue and just sort of what it's like to live the NBA schedule as opposed to just watching it as a fan from your couch, which is going to be the same for a road game or a home game. And then I also like to look at the very beginning of the schedule, and that's something where I want to start with this year's schedule is I looked at the first 10 games right before the Lakers' first road trip of 4 games, which is games 11 through 14. But the first 10 games, I'm like, let's go 8-2. We got a lot of winnable games to start off the year. And I do think that with a new team being able to get some good mojo at the beginning, and you know, we'll see if they're able to get that starting forward, I think that would make 8-2 a lot more doable and realistic. But I think they've got some really winnable games there. And then to your point about how the season ends, if you look at the last 10 games, it's a gauntlet. Now, one of the caveats to that is a lot of times those teams can be in different stages of let's rest up for the playoffs, that what can look formidable today, that night that the game actually rolls around, it's like, that OKC team or this other team isn't nearly as scary as they were in August, but Lakers are going to have their work cut out for them to end the season. If those teams are playing for something, as I expect a good amount of them to be, and they're still healthy. So that's kind of where I go. So what are your thoughts on that start of the season idea?
No, I think it's super important. And I remember, was it Russ's first year? But the sort of not being able to get off to a good start and finding yourself behind the eight ball and how challenging it was for multiple seasons in a row there for the Lakers, where they ended up essentially having to push really hard near the end of the year just to make the play-in. And the work you do at the beginning of the year is critical, not only to gain momentum and find your sea legs early, but to give you a buffer for the different parts of the year that are inherently going to drag you down, right? And so you talk about going to the road trips next and having multiple 5-game road trips or a 7-game trip or these stretches where it's like you bookend a 4-game trip, but with you play in LA against a good team, and then you go out on the road and then you come back and you play a good team again. And I always look at a road trip as actually being like 2 games longer than what it actually is, because you play at home and then odds are is you either hop on a plane that night or leave the next day. So you're in City A, which is Los Angeles, and then the next day you fly to City B and then you go on your road trip and then you come home and then you play again at home. And I get you, you're in your own bed and the familiar surroundings, a home crowd and everything else, but your body doesn't necessarily know that this new city is not just another stop after flying 1,000 miles or whatever you were coming back from Milwaukee the night before. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you're not settled into that city quite yet.
So for me, Pete, it's like the idea of starting out well and starting out strong and the schedule maybe assisting you, I think it's important. And when you look at these first 10 games or so, Golden State and then the Clippers at Utah and then home against Portland and with another back-to-back against the Clippers and then at Golden State, I also like the ability of seeing the same team multiple times early in the season to get a familiarity with the group and have it be like, okay, we just did this game plan as well. And what are our adjustments to something that we just did? I also think that can allow you to get into a rhythm or at least have this sense of familiarity where it's not, oh man, a whole brand new game plan again, which I think can also be important for a brand new team where it's, look, guys, we just did this against the Warriors like a week ago. Let's go out and do it again. Where are the avenues for adjustments? What are the things we have to do? And I think that can be helpful to a new team that's a veteran group but hasn't had a lot of reps together.
I do think the first half of the year is a decent amount easier than the second half of the year. I also know that I think they're tied for the league lead in how often they got to play 5 games in 7 nights. And that's one of the places where I think the team being younger is, I want to see that manifest in them being able to sustain that a bit better. Not just younger, but deeper. Right? They chose to go a route where they acquired one bona fide starter in Kessler, but then tried to get as deep as possible, younger as possible, that I think that they are positioned to be able to kind of weather that 5 games in 7 nights a lot better than they have in the past, where I think in previous seasons, there was always a game or sometimes two in those stretches where it's like, we're benching everybody. We're like, all the main guys are going to sit out and we know this is probably going to be a loss. I think that's going to be less essential over this year.
Let's take a break here, Pete. When we come back, I want to drill down into that idea more.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. TNCs apply.
I'm not going to blame LeBron for this necessarily, but I am going to contextualize it around having the oldest player in the league on your team. in that no one understood his body better and his ability to get ready for a game better and what he needed to deploy over any stretch of any given game better than LeBron in order to get you in a position to be close at the end to win. I always thought part of the Lakers' success in clutch moments wasn't just because they had good clutch players and good clutch performers in terms of Luka and LeBron and Austin, guys who I trust at the end of ball games, but it was because I also trusted that LeBron had managed his energy in a certain way, where yes, at the end of the game, he had it in order to close where other teams might not. You know what I mean?
This is always, to me, why the net rating argument was sort of missing the forest from the trees with the Lakers, is that you have the player probably more so than anyone in NBA history who knew exactly what they needed to do to win that particular night, especially in a regular season game, and would manage it as such. I remember a couple years back when AD was still on the team, Lakers had won in Charlotte, and it was when Charlotte was really bad, and it was not a convincing win at all. It was like a 6 or 8 point win where we were white-knuckling it and annoyed at the team throughout the whole time. And afterward, LeBron was like, we didn't come here to win by 30. We just came here to win, paraphrasing. But that's basically what he said. I think that was true of how he calculated it on a night-to-night basis, and nobody knew better than him kind of what needed to be done to win that game, even if it wasn't the prettiest.
Sometimes, though, Pete, I felt like that ability and understanding was not absorbed by his teammates via osmosis.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
Of course not.
And so there were nights where I'm just like, how come Rui's energy or player Y's energy, like Ayton, sometimes even Jackson, whoever, like guys whose individual motivations shouldn't necessarily be impacted by the best player, but we know that's not how life works. We understand that it's just like almost everyone, especially in a flow sport and a team sport, it's all connected to each other. And it's why the ability of one player to come in off the bench who plays incredibly hard, for example, can change the tenor of the game and uplift your team in a lot of ways. And so, again, I don't want to frame this through a negative prism of LeBron, but I do think that there were plenty of times where maybe his lull or his sort of coasting or his sort of understanding of I'm going to feel the game out at the beginning could impact his teammates in ways where they were just like, oh, this is what we're doing today? Okay, we're going to coast a little bit more. And now what I'm hopeful for, at least, is that the drivers of the team, Luka and Austin, especially Luka's penchant to come out of the gates fast and hard and looking to impact the game early, can be the driver for the team in terms of getting up and how that combines with the youth and some of the depth to say, no, we can survive some of these stretches a little bit better.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things I'm really hoping for with this year's team, is that it's much more of a squad that's able to play consistently over the course of 48, no matter how good they are, just be able to give kind of that consistent effort throughout. Like, that was one thing we saw the last few years, is worst team in the NBA was the Lakers when they went up by 20. But I do think it has a playoff impact of, if you're not used to playing 48 minutes pretty much ever, it can be very difficult to turn that on over the course of the playoffs. And even if you look at the OKC series, it wasn't really a walk down type of series where they would just take a 2 point lead and turn it into 5, then 9 and 13 over the course of time. It was these one little stretch where the Lakers would really let their foot off the gas. And then in the blink of an eye, it goes from a 4 point game to a 19 point game. And that was that. And I think that them being able to manage that is going to be super important this year. And I think there's a different dynamic. That said, both Luka and Austin, we lost them due to injury at the end of last year in a way that, like, how do you view sort of the management of minutes and of all of this? Because there's a tension between that of, like, we're going to be this younger team that can withstand the 5 games in 7 nights and play a full 48 more often than previous years. But the whole point is to get to the finish line and have Luka and Austin and just all of those guys healthy as well. So how do you gauge all of that?
Yeah, and I think that this is a great point, and it's something that, especially when you talk about Luka and Austin, the individual players, like medical people and the people around them who help influence player availability decisions as well. I'm not naive to the idea that part of LeBron's process for being ready was whether or not his own people were like, yeah, we're ready to go. Just like I think the same would be said of Luka, and I'm wondering if the same will be true of Austin now that Austin's a $40 million player a year. So I say all that to say that it's going to be a group decision around like player availability. And I also think players are going to need to be honest about like where they're at physically. And is it the right thing to continue to stay in this game or play or push a couple of days later? I remember when Luka got hurt towards the end of the year, Pete, like that whole game he was laboring against OKC. He was not moving very well. And I don't want to say that specifically led to him getting hurt later in the game, but the optics weren't great to me that he was like gingerly moving around on his leg earlier in the game. And then later that game, he makes like a high torque play and then comes up and his hamstring is basically ruined to the point where he doesn't play the rest of the year. And I get that everyone has to sign off on that. It's just tricky. That said, I don't know, man. Sometimes injuries also feel so random. I guess what I really want is for the team to be in the best of condition early in the year, for them to train their bodies for what it's going to take in order to survive a long regular season, and that they basically just put themselves in the best condition possible to be in the best position possible to be able to sustain over a long season. Because I actually don't believe in the idea that it's like, okay, we're going to scale you down and we're going to rest you for all of these nights so that you'll be ready. It's just like, you can't bubble wrap these guys for the entire year and then expect them to be able to play high leverage playoff games like and go for 40 minutes sometimes during the postseason in order to win you a basketball game. This is a whole different discussion outside of the schedule.
Yeah,
Pete,
sorry
but,
about that.
But
yeah.
No, but I think it is an important part of things, particularly when you go from a 3-star build to a 2-star build, because you do have to say, like, what is most important with this?
And one thing I'm excited about, and this is something I've felt about the organization for a bit, is like, you don't have LeBron to blame or to be like, this is the reason why we are this way anymore. Like, let's see what you're about in terms of managing the schedule, in terms of managing player minutes and the night-to-night motor that a team has. And as a separate thought, I hope they still have those plans in place to build the recovery lab and what we were talking about yesterday about the, that's part of the reason why the South Bay Lakers moved to the Coachella Valley is to free up this space for this kind of health and wellness, really top of the line type of place that might be the best free agent acquisition of all is if you can get Luka and Austin and guys like that to the finish line in part because you've invested more in their health. I think that that might be the most important thing of all. So I really hope that they're able to continue that. Back to the schedule before we wrap up on this. Any other elements of this that sort of stand out to you?
No, not necessarily. I always do look at the Grammy trip as sort of the barometer, as a good test for like where the team is at. And I'm always interested to see what that trip looks like in terms of quality of opponent. And this year, Pete, it does not disappoint. First of all, before they even leave for the Grammy trip, they play at home against OKC. So it's like they go a back-to-back Golden State and Sac, then a night off, and then Washington, and then a night off, and then it's OKC, and then they go on the road. And then the road trip is the Pacers, the Knicks, the Hornets, who are improved, but obviously we'll see if they stay improved after the LaMelo trade, right? Then Boston, Brooklyn, and then they come back west and play San Antonio and then Phoenix. When you talk about the Pacers, the Knicks, the Celtics, the Spurs, and then a Suns team that really gave them problems last year and is a try-hard, like, competitive group, that is going to be a hellish Grammy road trip, Pete. And when you started out with a home game against OKC, and my point earlier about how the game before you go on the road is actually like game one of a trip to me, that is going to be like, I don't want to call it like the make it or break it part of the season, but I do think it is very much the measuring stick moment for the team that over that 2-week stretch, we're going to learn a fair amount about who the Lakers are.
From like mid to late January on, Lakers are going to be in a crucible there. And to your point earlier, like, get some wins early on. Get that buffer early on. And while you're learning what your new team is, you still have these winnable games where you can make mistakes but still pick up the W while you're improving. And so I think that's really kind of the roadmap for the season is let's get off to a good start. so that they're in as good of a position as possible when they get to that Grammy road trip, where you're going to drop some games no matter how good of a job that you do. And toward the end of the season, again, look at the last 10 games. We're looking at Miami, at Cleveland, at Houston, at Memphis, at OKC, then end the season on a 5-game homestand: San Antonio, Dallas, Minnesota, Minnesota, Phoenix. Interesting, we played Minnesota 4 times this year, and both times, or all 4 times, are in back-to-backs. Like, we're at Minnesota on December 16th and 18th, and then we're at home against Minnesota on April 7th and April 9th. So between the Grammy road trip that you talked about there, and then the last 10 games of the season, that's a rough one. And in between, by the way, in between those two segments, you've got Cleveland, New York, OKC, Philly, Orlando, Denver, Houston again, Denver again, right? So it's not like it's easy in those spaces in between that either. So last part of the season is going to be tough for the Lakers. Let's take a break here. We're going to come back and switch gears and say farewell to a couple of NBA legends. So, Dee, for a lot of our younger fans, the hatred of the Celtics and the Lakers-Celtics rivalry can be a little bit blurry for them in terms of the reasons why. And it's born in mostly the 1960s, where the Celtics were dominant, and I think at one point they won 8 in a row. And the Lakers were on the wrong side of that several times. And one of the defining factors of those series was something crazy would happen where they'd be like, these MFers are so freaking lucky, right? The old, you know, leprechaun sitting on top of the backboard that would just make the craziest shit go their way. And one of the defining moments of that is in Game 7 of the 1969 Finals, the Celtics are up by 1. I think it's 103-102 with like a minute 30 left. And Keith Erickson, who was the color guy before Stu Lance and played with the Lakers for a few years, gets a back tap steal, or so we think, right? One of those ones where you reach around, knock it away from behind, strips it from Havlicek, caroms off somebody, bounces right to Don Nelson at the free throw line. So that's lucky in and of itself that the ball bounces right back to them. The shot clock's about to expire. Nelson elevates, ball hits the back of the rim, goes 10 feet up in the air, and swishes through. One of those shots, like, come on. And it's the really defining play of the 1969 Finals. And Don Nelson went on to become a great head coach, super innovative head coach. I think he's still number 2 all time in wins. But even beyond that, I think very influential in the style of basketball that we see. And he passed away over the course of this past week. And Dee, I know you wanted to talk about this. What do you remember about Nelly Ball and just Don Nelson himself?
So the shot that you're talking about, he lives in Celtics lore for that shot. And I said to you, Pete, that one of the great legacies to me that Don Nelson leaves behind for me personally is that he's someone who, after all of that history with the Celtics, that, like, removing the stink of him being a former Celtic and all that he accomplished in the league that had nothing to do with the Celtics is probably one of his greatest legacies to me. That's how influential he was and how his post-playing career was so important to, I think, like, the shape of the league and what the style and the version of basketball that is played now. I think Don Nelson's fingerprints are all over that. We talk about coaches' ability to evolve and change with the times. And Pete, in the 1980s, before Don Nelson coached the Mavs and before he coached the Warriors, and he had 2 stints with the Warriors, he coached the Milwaukee Bucks, and that Bucks team was a team that never got over the hump. They were never able to really get past the Celtics or the 76ers. And then later in the decade, the Pistons, they were essentially like that second tier contending team. One of his best players was Alvin Robertson, who was a great defensive guard. He coached Sidney Moncrief and several other like high-level players that were two-way players. And I recall some of the reputation of those teams as like a defense-first team. Then he coaches in Golden State, Pete, and it's like he coaches these great offensive juggernaut teams with the great Run TMC group, which was an awesome nickname, but it was Chris Mullin and Mitch Richmond and Tim Hardaway, and this sort of great, like, perimeter, backcourt, shooting, playing fast, small ball style of basketball that was, like, revolutionary back then and really pushing the pace. And then Pete, his career with the Mavs, where he was instrumental in developing Steve Nash into what Steve Nash became. He was instrumental in the drafting of Dirk Nowitzki and the sort of highlighting of like international players and being on the forefront of small ball basketball and pace and space. A lot of the stuff that they attribute to D'Antoni is like some of that was definitely built off the back of Don Nelson. And then when he returned to Golden State, that was during a time where I lived in the Bay Area and I was going to a ton of Warriors games at that time. I just remember the sort of spirit that he imbued with that sort of Island of Misfit Toys team with Matt Barnes and Steven Jackson and Al Harrington and Jason Richardson and Baron Davis and all of these guys, and famously how he game planned and schemed as the 8 seed for the We Believe Warriors team to knock off the top seeded Mavs, a version of that team that he essentially coached before, right, that Avery Johnson inherited. And that team will always hold a special place in my heart just because of how, like, the local team, even if they're not your team, when you live in a city and the city embraces a group the way that Oakland embraced that We Believe team, there's like nothing better than that. And Nelly was right in the middle of that, and his sort of free spirit and all of that. Like, I just wanted to make sure that we paid proper tribute to who I think is like one of the true legends of the game. And again, someone who has Celtics roots, but I never think of him that way because he's done so much after that.
One of his most important legacies is it can be very easy, especially in these high paid, high stakes, super competitive. Like, think about all the people in the world that would love to be an NBA head coach, and there's only 30 of them. And even back then, we're talking like 24 jobs available for that. Is having the courage to be a little weird and a little bit outside of the box relative to the era that you're in. When you were describing that Milwaukee Bucks team from the 80s, which I want to reiterate was never talented enough to compete with those Celtics and those Sixers teams, they were just a tier below that. So I wouldn't have expected any coach to kind of get more out of them. But you're talking about Alvin Robertson and Sidney Moncrief, these great defensive players. Part of that too, and part of how it worked, was a guy in Jack Sikma at the 5 spot who's actually playing off of the perimeter in ways that is much more common now to have your 5 at the top of the key and be able to knock down shots. Now, this is back in an era where it was like, no, shoot that 20-footer instead of spacing it out to the 3-point line. But he was just super innovative in that respect. He was one of the first coaches to really embrace the European style of play and European players. There was such a stigma to European players at one point of, they're soft, you can't win with them. And Don Nelson absolutely did that. And Dirk was one of the main guys who kicked the hole in the sky and was like, no, not only can I do this as a supporting type of piece, but I can be the main guy on this type of team. And so I will always respect Don Nelson's ability to be a little bit weird and a little bit unconventional and sort of push the boundaries. And not everything that he tried worked out, but I just appreciate his ability to push the game forward by just not following in the steps of everybody else.
The sort of positional rigidity that existed back in the 70s and 80s and yep. into the first part of the 90s, Don Nelson bucked those trends more often than any other coach.
This is such a great point, Dee. I just want to jump in. The idea of positionless basketball, a huge pioneer in this idea.
So I just wanted to highlight that exact point as well, that when it really was an era of the point guard was the person and player who was supposed to do all of that stuff, Nelly was never afraid to say, but the players on my teams are good at this, and so we're going to allow them to do this, and we're going to grow their games or develop them or deploy them in this specific way. And so rest in peace.
Dee, I know that we wanted to get to Russell Westbrook's retirement, and we will, but we'll do that on one of our next pods. I'm glad we sort of spent the time that we did on Don Nelson, certainly deserving. So rest in peace to the great Don Nelson. We'll talk about Russ's retirement a little bit next week, and a whole lot more. Certainly an eventful August for our Lakers and the NBA. But until then, everybody have a great weekend. You've been listening to Laker Film Room Podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.
James has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn. He's double teamed. Just pass out of front. Broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
And Magic got it. Magic fires. It's good. And the Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game. Rebound to Lottie.
play. Van Exel the winner. It's on the way.
Kobe Bryant, 48 points, 16 rebounds. Shaq with his eighth block shot that ties an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
right, in Boston.
In Boston.
Of all places.
Are you kidding me?
Kobe. Hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal. Are you kidding me?
Lakers looking to push. Bryant spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Pretty pass. And it's back to a three-point game.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Bell.
There's the move. Two. One.
Miss it.
Bryant. For the victory.
It's over.
Shot clock now to five. Bryant. Yes.
And that was a little tough to Alvin Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?
2.1 seconds remaining. Denver a foul to give. Jokic trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis, 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good. Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers. James again. Oh, he hits another one. LeBron James putting together a closing quarter against the Nuggets.
This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquer the bubble, and banner number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.